independence. And by the way, our constitution is full of that. The provisions relating to setting up the orders of general and so on all state how you get independence. One of them is, for example, not having renewable appointments. People have got a non-renewable fixed term, so the orders of general, or they have been determined to be the right of the But you shouldn't have something between the two. You should not have renewable terms. And with that, we can say that
the bottom line is the crisis is much more dramatic and serious than has generally been acknowledged or recognized in South Africa. If it is not resolved, we cannot have growth and jobs. And the way to resolve it is to have a truly independent system operator and system owner, and that has to be clarified and that should be clear. Then other issues might arise, like what about cross subsidies? And the answer is that's not the function of a generating provider. That's the function of welfare. It should come out of a separate and different budget. But we can go into some of those issues. But we need very clearly the principle that the grid will be like, for example, roads or airports in South Africa, where there's a total separation between suppliers of services and operators of the infrastructure or the network. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Madam Chwasa, I want to allow the members to make a presentation. I just have to highlight up front that we will stick to issues that relate to the deal, because whilst you may have done your best to articulate the background, but some of your areas in the background go beyond what we are here for. But obviously, from time to time, we'll be handling those things. By the way, one of the things we've introduced in this parliament is energy public meetings, two of which have been held, and another one is forthcoming this next month, where we will, 11th of June, I've just been reminded, where we will try and pick up topics to deal with and allow the public as much as possible. But rather now, we'll definitely focus on issues relating to the bill and even broader background issues that directly relate to the bill. Honourable members, welcome, and friends, please, comments, questions, and things. Baba Kreling, followed by Baba Smale, for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just, is the opposition Baba and the ANC Tata? Is that, he always referred to as Baba Kreling. I agree with your presentation. Just a couple of points. I mean, firstly, the one about Duva is that it has in fact been investigated and there is a report. The problem is it hasn't been tabled in Parliament, and it is something which I think we should push for. But I know it doesn't refer to
Duva. I know I owe you on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we do need to see what the details are there. We've had a number of presentations on the ISMA bill. Not mine. And the presentation by ESCOM was to say that, I mean, clearly we've got a problem with IPPs. I think they only make up about 2% of our generating capacity at the moment. But the line from ESCOM was that they'll sign up any IPP that comes to them at the moment. And so the problem isn't with ESCOM. I'm just interested, because we need to get to the nub of this matter as to what is holding back IPPs in South Africa. And clearly ISMA is hopefully going to help that. But we also need to know if there's other problems that are holding back IPPs, and what, in your experience, do you think is the problem that's holding back IPPs, and why haven't we been able to make progress on that? Then you said that this bill doesn't really deal with the environmental considerations around energy. But in fact, there is a big issue around environmental considerations and something which we need to think of when dealing with the ISMA. Now, I agree with your written submission when you say there should be weeding through the grid, where, you know, big mining companies or big energy-intensive companies are able to procure their energy directly from an IPP. The problem is, though, and it was brought up by another presenter, is that how do we then ensure that our carbon constraints of the country is also kept in check? Because if we allow complete free-for-all, what would happen probably is that IPPs would simply put up coal-fired power stations all over the place, because that would probably be seen as the cheapest way of generating power. How do you think we should then limit the amount of coal-fired power stations or ensure that clean energy is in fact also produced by IPPs? Do you think it should be a licensing function, so we only license those power stations which actually conform to our carbon constraints? Or do you think it should be a role of a 20-year energy plan? Or do you think that ISMA should have some kind of stipulation to say that if you're going to wheel through the grid, at least 10% of the energy you buy has to come from clean energy? I'm just interested to hear what your kind of practical solutions are to that issue.
Honourable Smart.
The last one is my question, but Chair, I was on the transferring. If I listen to the presentation, that I understand the grid should fall under the ambits of ISMA. And some of the concerns that raised earlier by the previous presentation is the transferring of the assets cost-wise. The compensation of that transfer of assets, would you say that it can be transferred within the shareholder transfer, and that the shareholder remains the shareholder on the other side, but still doesn't lose the value of the asset? Or would you see it as a clean separation of a buy and a sell transaction that needs to take place in order to make this happen? And I would also be interested in understanding in the bill, when we live want to see IPPs being formed within this bill, that should we make provisions for the type of energy that we want to see IPPs wants to produce? And if so, then how?
Papa Lucas?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think when Mr. Lowe began, he said there's nothing wrong with ESCO. It's the policy. So why are we going this extra mile? Why don't we just repair the policy instead of going this route?
Karimlot.
Thank you, Chairperson. In your written submission, I think it's page 5, you're saying, let me just read it quickly. You said the problem of single monopoly grid owners cannot resolve by a strict regulation that prevents the grid owner from denying power producers and purchasers access to the grid for any reason other than the integrity of the grid, and ensuring that charges for access to the grid are equitable and uniformly applied. NERSA has applied to what? Let me finish there. Has published a consultation paper. Would you be able to share with us, after you've done the international scan that you talked about, would this proposal that you are putting forth resolve the problem of the transmission grid still being retained by ESCOM? The second question would be, I know this might be a bit broader. Maybe I should respect the chair's ruling on this matter and go to a different matter. It's on. So, you are raising concerns around Section 27, personnel of ISMO, and not treating ISMO as a branch of the public service. Are your concern mainly related to the powers of the minister in relation to this entity, or around the conditions of service and the determination of salary? Because when I read 27, it's more around the issue of condition of service, remuneration, and service benefits. And why would you have concern around this? Are you advocating a situation where ISMO can determine its own salary? For instance, if they are way above the norm that is applicable to other SOEs, let's assume ISMO CEO is paid two times the salary of CEO of Eskom. I'm just throwing in the question, and just to understand what are your concerns. Honourable Ross. Hello, this is working.
Thank you, Chair. In regard to the two independents, I'd just like to ask the question. The grid will be a massive asset, or is a massive asset in the hands of Eskom. And what would be the financial implications if we need to get to true independence if the grid is not within the hands of Eskom, in Eskom's funding models and how they will have the necessary assets to obtain those funding? That's the first one. The second one is on pricing, and it's to clarify NERSA's functions. If it's truly independent, we hopefully it will bring in the market principles based on supply and demand. And I think is that the objective towards we're working to? And what impact do you envisage will it have on pricing? Will it have, will it give us more reasonable electricity prices? Hopefully the market can determine that. And how does Eskom's role come into it in regulation, and is meant to be regulated by NERSA? How's NERSA's role, what will NERSA's role then be in terms of pricing? Thank you.
For now, that's the list of questions and comments. Back to the Freedom Market Foundation.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to ask Mr. Cooney to kick off and his response.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for the opportunity as well. I think if I go to the first questions in terms of what's keeping up IPPs, quite simply, the regulatory environment does not allow IPPs to participate in the power market unless a procurement program is run by some state entity at the moment. So either Eskom has to run a procurement program, or the National Treasury, as it's running the renewable energy program at the moment, has to run a procurement program. Otherwise, IPPs cannot enter the market. Very simply, the existing ERA 2006 did retain an option which was supported by NERSA of a willing buyer, willing seller. So IPPs would have been able to come into the market, build a power station, supply to a private off-taker, and would have needed a wheeling agreement with Eskom. The amendment to ERA 2006 removes that option, and therefore IPPs now have to be part of a procurement program, or if they want to supply independently to the grid, they would need ministerial permission. So the option is removed in terms of the amendment to the second ERA. In terms of carbon and types of energy, I just would like to perhaps correct what may be a misconception in the public eye. The renewable energy program is going to have quite a severe impact on the conventional power generation, where we currently have a shortage. Unless those renewable energy programs who come in have storage capacity, they're going to increase the demand on reserve margin, and we are short of reserve margin currently. So the implications of the power system are quite severe in terms of the conception that bringing in wind power, bringing in solar power, etc., is actually going to make the situation better. It's going to make it worse. And it's going to make it worse because we don't have enough conventional power generation. The conventional power generation that was supposed to come on stream in June 11 has now slipped towards the end of 2013. So we have more aggravation of the system. So I think it's important that, you know, that point is appreciated. in terms of the ESMO bill, I think, there was another question, sorry. You asked about wheeling. Was that correct, sir? Okay. The second amendment to the ERA 2006 does not mention wheeling. Wheeling is not in the Primary Act. The ESMO bill is not mentioned in the Primary Act. And therefore, these acts do not speak to each other coherently. and cohesively. It's a concern to us as independents because we have to contract. The contractual suite for an IPP is an extremely complicated process because it requires external funding. If the grid is owned by a separate legal entity to the operations, my power purchase agreement and my wheeling agreement will be separated, and the allocation of liability becomes a contractual nightmare for an IPP. And this there is an implication, therefore, on the financing of the project. So the structure of the bill, therefore, has an implication on the financing. In terms of carbon, sir, I think what we are looking at in terms of the 2030 plan, according to the IRP 210, in my opinion, is very ambitious. And the reason it's ambitious is we first have to catch up with the backlog of power in this country. We will not get growth in the economy unless we catch up with the power. And the power backlog at the moment is running into thousands of megawatts. China has not done it. India has not done it in terms of carbon taxes, etc. And unless we discover oil tomorrow or a huge gas find tomorrow, the coal is in the ground over here. We understand it. We mine it in rands. We produce it in rands. We charge in rands. In the short term, that's our only option. And so in terms of the short-term coal-fired power stations, yes, I have to agree that the IPPs at this stage would look at producing power from coal as far as base load is concerned. This is apart from the renewable energy program being run by the Treasury Department. Is that a... yep. So, beg your pardon, sir. Can you please continue? Yes, sir. There was the next question on the transfer of assets in terms of cost-wise compensation, etc., whether the shareholder would be the same or would it be a transaction of selling the transmission assets. I believe the shareholder is the same shareholder. Mr. Lowe raised the point of whether it should be private or not, but I don't think that's the issue. The true independence is just the separation of the grid and the system operations into a separate, independent legal entity apart from Eskom. The shareholder would be the same, so the transactional arrangements as to how that asset is transferred would be up to the shareholder.
Meaning the state.
Meaning the state, yes. If I may, sir, I think there was a question on why are we dealing with Eskom and not the policy. Is that correct, sir?
It was said that the only policy the problem with Eskom was the policy, not Eskom. Therefore, I'm saying, why the heck are we wasting our time?
So my response to that is, if we want to see private capital enter the supply side of the market, then it needs to be dealt with in terms of the Eskom structure. If Eskom retains control over its operations and the transmission of power, then it is a referee, a player, an umpire in the same business. And I think that's the reason why the ISMO bill has been introduced. May I pass over to you, Leon, to address the other?
Leon, maybe before you do that, may I address some aspect of a question that was raised, I think, by the Honourable Member of Parliament and also maybe another Member of Parliament. Now, very briefly, we need to really, really, really come to terms with a very serious fact, and that is the environmental standards that are being imposed on us as a developing economy, a developing country, have very serious cost implications for running businesses, for the economy. They have very, very serious implications for us. And so we need to ask those questions very, very seriously. And when we look at the environmental concerns that have translated into actual policies in developed economies, we must ask as to what the cost implications are going to be for us as a developing country. That's that's facing the challenge of generating jobs and that, and therefore starting with stimulating entrepreneurial activity, getting businesses off the ground, and so on and so forth. And then there was an issue that was raised as to regarding the grid perhaps being in the hands of a private business competitor or something like that. The beauty of that, of putting as much of the energy sector in private hands, is that you don't have to do anything with the taxpayers. You don't have to rely on the taxpayers when the business fails. And if you are a business contemplating being involved in the energy sector, one of the things that you have to exercise your mind on is whether it's going to be economically viable. If it's not going to be economically viable, you're not going to go into business. And however, if you always have the confidence that whatever may happen, you can always rely on the taxpayers, you are going to proceed with as much of the business being in state hands as possible. I thought I should just dwell on that as a matter of principle. Thank you. It might not necessarily respond to your question.
Chair, if I can just add a few little points. One is that the question of the environmental questions, I think the issue for us is really we are not experts on environmental issues. What we are experts on is that you need a level playing field. In other words, the rules must be the same for all operators. And if, for example, to build on Temba's point, if the environmental concerns are to be funded out of the treasury as opposed to operators, then that's a finance decision. That's really the right way to do it. In other words, for the country to make a clear decision about how much it's willing to invest in environmental concerns and to come out of general finance rather than to make that a condition for operating. But that's a different issue. Whatever the policy is, it must be the same for all players. Then the issue, sir, about the why are we wasting our time, you put that quite strongly. I think the issue is the policy failure is that we didn't create an ISMO. That's the failure. So the government should have gone ahead with what's been happening all over the world, and we've been left behind. I think that's really the issue. And this has actually been government policy for a long time. I mean, it's really, by implication, what's even in the Electricity Act. So the policy failure is a failure either to translate into something like this bill the big policy of bringing in competition and choice that has not yet happened, and this is your opportunity to bring that about, to end the policy failure, sir. Then on the question of the issue of the one question was, what's the problem if the grid is retained by Eskom? I think the issue there is you're then not going to get IPPs, and you're not going to have a level playing field, and you're not going to have choice and competition. You can't. It's, again, if I say, for example, if Comair owned the airports, would SA Airways be able to operate effectively? The answer is obviously no, or vice versa. So you do need to have ownership separated. Otherwise, then you really, to use your words, sir, are we wasting our time? And then on the question, sir, of Section 27, you raise a good point. I think in our text, we make the point, we don't say what it actually says, we just say it should be clear that it's not part of the public service, that this is a state-owned enterprise. It should, in other words, when you unbundle Eskom into the grid and the generation, the ISMO, the grid, should be the same as Eskom. It's another state-owned enterprise, and it should determine its own salaries, and it should operate as a business. I think that's really what we're saying. And I think Eskom's point about aspects of the bill not being clear is correct. So we're just saying get clarity on those kinds of questions. This is a genuinely independent enterprise with, as Doug Cooney says, the same owner, which, by the way, means there's no loss of assets. This is just an unbundling. It's just taking the grid into a separate state-owned enterprise. There's really no significant, it's technically a problem administratively, but it's not conceptually a problem. You're just splitting
the generating from the transmission, and then and you just tell the accountants to get on with that. And then on the final question was, what should nurses' role in pricing be? And I think the answer is eventually, if not initially, no role. Initially, you have the problem, of course, with effectively 98% or 95% or whatever it is of generation being in the hands of one operator, so that tends to have a pricing implication. But I want to make a statement here about pricing which might sound radical, but the point about prices is that prices are the way in which people know how to operate. Now, when Eskom asks for price increases, it's now asked for effectively a 50% increase, which means from the prices 10 years ago would be effectively 300% when you compound it. So we're talking about serious impact on the economy. But Eskom is right in the sense that you have to have supply and demand. That's the job of prices. Now, you can solve the energy crisis by midnight tonight by raising the price enough. It will push consumption down. The trouble, as we all know, is that if you do that, then we're going to cut back on mining and cut back on production. So we want cheap energy, but we don't want blackouts. Now, the point is you can't have both. If you don't have enough generating capacity, you either then have to subsidize people to not employ or not produce, which is what we're doing, or you have to say to people, don't develop. I'm going to mention a little anecdote here, because people don't tend in these lofty circles to discuss what happens to ordinary people on the ground. My brother and sister-in-law wanted to build a retirement home in a little village called Vokerstrom, which, by the way, should be called Slapstrom or Dirtstrom, but nonetheless it's called Vokerstrom. But they couldn't get their building plans passed because there wasn't enough electricity. Now, this is just an ordinary retiring couple wanting to build a small retirement home in a small village. Can't do it. So this is not just not building factories and mines and shopping centers and hospitals, which we can't do because there's not enough power. This is the entire, every citizen is impacted by this in a very serious way. So what you want NERSA to do is as quickly as possible get out of trying to regulate the economic aspects of energy. Let those be the function of what the Act envisages, competition and choice. That's what we need to see as our vision. That's where we're going. How quite to get there? And that's where we're going. I don't think that's under debate. I think we all agree. I think that's the government's policy. And until maybe your appearance of Eskom with you was even Eskom's policy. So there seems to be consensus that what we need is a market, a viable, competitive market where prices determine who is and isn't in the market and what consumption patterns there are. So we need to be clear that that's where we're going. The process of getting there requires careful and skillful political and administrative management. And there will be a role for NERSA in that process, but it should be clear that that role should lapse as soon as is reasonably possible, as soon as there's an effective competitive market, as, for example, happened with airlines. SA Airways was very, very similar, had about 98% of the market. We unbundled into a private airports company, and same as we should say should happen with ISMO, and entry of IPPs, Comair, etc., and created a level playing field. So in the early stages, there would have been some need for political supervision of SAA, but that's fallen away completely. SAA must just now compete on a level playing field with every other operator, and all the only thing about SAA is the shareholder is the state. That's how Eskom will be in the future, as envisaged in the government's existing policy, and what we're saying is implement it properly and remove the ambiguity and make sure the ownership is clear from the bill, that the ownership passes. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm looking at your submission, which was submitted earlier. In page 10, you share the experience that the best structure is not a single government monopoly such as ESCOM, with centrally controlled oversight and direction. Much better structures are those that evolved and continue to evolve in the European Union countries based in the UK example and the structure that has developed in the North America. Now, I'll question the purpose of this statement, because why are we here then? Why are we here? We're trying to restructure, but still, the Free Market Foundation is still coming with such, you know, hammering, you know, statements. I mean, what are you trying to tell us?
Sorry, do you
know? No. Okay. I'm chairing the meeting.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought you were asking. No.
I'll give you the time
okay.
to respond. One of the things that the Department of Energy raised was that the direction that's being taken here takes cue from global models, but it's a partial, what do they say? Yeah, it's a hybrid approach. So obviously there's an expression that attempts are being done to shift. So whilst one has to desist of being defensive, but still, we cannot afford but comment on that kind of statements. I mean, this is for public consumption. We can't just keep quiet as if, you know, the state is not doing something to shift from the Estoril monopoly configuration. I'm not an expert in this area, but I've done a little bit of reading, and I've realized that there are practices and models of the ISO, definitely. In fact, some of the presentation that's coming, I think particularly the faith community's submission, all of members will see that they even give references, they show, you know, trying to compare what we're doing, which is what one would expect. I don't think I'm putting mouths words into your mouth, but, you know, in page 7, somewhere you make reference to section 4.3e, Roman 2. Somewhere there you refer to that ISMO will be expected to perform some of the political role. You see, such statements, you need to be very clear. What does that mean? Where does that emanate from? So that we be clear that we may not be overlooking something that may have a bad impact down the line. Once again, there's a reference to the problem of a single monopoly grid owner. I think the department must take this into account, you know, when it responds, that the grid ownership, to what extent is this going to be reconfigured or not reconfigured post-ISMO era? Not much to Free Market Foundation, but that's a matter of interest to us. Because when this single monopoly reference comes time and again, it then creates an impression on us that it doesn't seem that the ISMO is really addressing the single monopoly arrangement that's there. We're very conscious of it. We acknowledge it as Parliament, and that's why we are ensuring that there's public hearings for that matter. Page 4, third paragraph, somewhere it says, a market in the electricity increases efficiency considerably. I'm sure I'll be very, very interested to get some guidance. The considerable increase of efficiency in that. It's helpful, you know, to learn as we move along. But by the way, one of the things that one has realized that ISMO is but just by a cog in the wheel in an overall project of the restructuring the electricity supply industry. I think one of the members should look at this bill as triggering that. If we're not alert to that.
In fact, also that is triggered by one of your statements in page 2, which says that if Mobil hold out hope for swift solution to the problem, it is impossible to tell from reading the bill. That, to me, to a great extent, confirms the fact that the bill is just but one cog in the wheel. One of the members still have a lot to work out on this bill. Unless I missed here, in articulating your background, Mr. Lowe, you made reference to dubious decisions and lack of expertise. One would be keen to pick up what exactly are those decisions and which expertise do we lack in. At times, you know, would like to move at speed, but we don't want to leave certain stones unturned, because we may have to conduct some oversight on that if need be. Mr. I concur with you. The Mitupi model and other models in terms of bucks, that is money, is also a cause for concern. You start with one amount and it ends up, you know, at triple or quadruple the amount for all political parties. Even let me go to that extreme. I just concerned on Sustandi. You know, on Sustandi, so they say in African. Surely, when projects of this nature are handled by experts, then you expect experts to articulate, you know, the most optimal, you know, cost. Of course, giving room for changes, because costs are going up and things, but when they go up so markedly, you start asking exactly what's going on. You know, I really concur with that. But once again, you say 14 years of unresolved, you know, problem. But then, why are we here? I thought, you know, as government or as the state as a whole, you know, sometimes you take things step by step. And whilst the electricity as part of energy is very fundamental, it's also as a motive, you know. Though, of course, I do expect that the state has to take some decisions at times. It's belated. Let's be honorable members. This thing is, when you read, you know, you find that all this IPPs was raised long time ago. Sometimes you don't pick up why did it delay, but I'm a bit uneasy, honestly. I know it's your right to present, to regard it as just an unresolved, you know, maybe technicalities, but once again, we are here to ensure, we've allowed public hearings to ensure that, you know, we trigger a path of resolving. But by the way, we're even concerned from our side to those who made submissions and didn't come for oral presentations. How would have loved that 100% of the submissions should have been followed by 100% of oral presentation, because we want to be influenced. Want to take into account issues that would strengthen the bill. I think that's all from my side. Honorable Kreling and Honorable Ross and Honorable Mlott.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I really want to unpackage this issue more, because we have to get to the bottom of this, because it has severe implications for the drafting of this bill, and it's something we have to deal with. Now, I hear your complaints around the carbon constraints and how it's affecting business. And stuff. Okay. the point is, when it comes to carbon constraints, I mean, many countries in the world are having this debate at the moment, and in every country, the business sector is crying as well that, you know, this is having problems in terms of our global competitiveness. So South Africa is not unique in that situation. The issue is, though, and we have to face up to the reality, that we are going to be faced with carbon constraints in South Africa, whether we like it or not. The question is how much those carbon constraints will be, and a lot of this is also a product of international negotiations. Also, how much support are we going to get from more developed countries, more wealthier countries in terms of financial flows and things like that. So clearly that's a debate that's happening. For this particular issue, though, what we need to accept is the political reality that we're going to have carbon constraints. Now, the issue to you, then, is to say how best do we deal with this in a situation where we're allowing wheeling through the grid? So it's not good enough to simply say, well, you know, we have to allow IPPs to simply go and build as many coal-fired power stations as possible. That clearly isn't going to work in a context of carbon constraints and a government policy that is seeking to control that. So my question to you, though, is to say, what is the best way of dealing with that? I'm not against IPPs building coal-fired power stations. I'm just against a complete free-for-all where that will be the only decision that gets taken. Now, we've already seen in the case of Exxaro, they've already tied up with Tata Energy. And what they're saying is, yes, we will build some coal-fired power stations, but we're also looking at clean energy. We're also looking at wind, and we're looking at solar. The issue is, how do we legislate for this year? What is the best solution? Now, I need you to give me answers on this. You know, is it a licensing thing? So, in other words, we won't license an IPP if it's just a coal-fired power station? Or are we going to say to energy-intensive users that want to buy power that's been wheeled through the grid, that you have to buy a certain percentage that is going to be clean energy? We need to get to grips with this and what's going to be the best solution in that regard. Thank you.
For once, I'm with you, Dominic.
For once?
Thanks, Chair. My question is in regard to the proposed process of implementation of the ESMA, and I think there's broad consensus that we need the ESMA. On the different technologies that we're going to be using, as Honourable Craig said, it's indeed problematic if we move back to hugely dependent on coal-fired plants. We were hoping that the ESMA will bring in a different scenario, but we understand, and I think there's a huge responsibility of this committee, Chair, after today's presentation also, that we understand that we need to secure supply in the short term until we get to a situation where indeed the renewable energy can kick in and solve our electricity problems. But we have coal, and we have to put our shoulder to the wheel to see that the shortage of supply are met. And as you correctly said, I think there's 3,000 megawatts of shortfall of supply at this point in time, even more perhaps. But I think we're having very good presentations and also background studies done by Professor Eberhardt. And in his presentation to us, he also says the bill is most welcome. And then he elaborates on the ESMA has the full responsibility for the preparation and regular updating of the IRP, in the Integrated Resource Plan. Now, that brings us back to a huge responsibility on this committee. And he then says, and just to cut it short, he says he would like to elaborate on these issues adhering to the Parliamentary Portfolio of Committee of Energy. And once we have all this information, I was just wondering, and I know it could have been addressed by you, but are we contemplating to ask Professor Eberhardt to give us more information on this bill? Because I can clearly see it's a complex situation now happening with the ESMA. How are we going to implement the process, the responsibility of the shortfall of supply in the shorter term, And to get to a situation where we can once again hold up our heads and say, yes, we are moving towards renewables?
Yes, we did. Owen was not around, but the colleague, you know, we made it very clear that we'd need more information. And I'm sure the committee secretary would ensure that before we do deliberations, that information should be with us and circulated.
The point that I actually wanted to make, Chair, and thank you for allowing me to say this, it's about the proposed amendments to the ERA Act and then the coordination with the ESMA bill, coordinating that. I think that's a huge responsibility, and I think we also need some clarity and guidance in terms of what is the proposal, what should be amended, because we're not legal experts, and I think that would be most welcome and will give us some guidance.
last week we did raise that, and we expect advice from our legal advisors, both the state law advisor as well as our own parliamentary legal advisor. Very, very soon they have to come back and advise us on that. Once again, a number of submissions have raised that. You know, so we're pretty alert to that. Thanks in any case. Salam Lok.
I think the Honourable Khayling, you know, really put the point across quite forcefully on the concerns around IPPs just being geared for building coal-fired power stations. Because I had an impression that the IRP was giving a certain, you know, trajectory in terms of our energy development, but I wouldn't want to go there. First question, it's around, which was not answered. You have said NERSAP has published a consultation paper. I'm reading because most of your submission is around who controls the transmission grid. I think that is the main crux of your submission. So you are saying NERSAP has published a consultation paper with the title, that's page 5, regulatory rules on network charges for third-party transportation of energy. I assume you have read the consultation paper, hence you have raised in the submission. I just want to find out from your in your view, would that really solve the problem if the transmission grid still is in the hands of ESCOM? Second question is, you have made some a remark, it's not in your submission, on cross-subsidization. You said cross-subsidization should be a welfare matter. It shouldn't be left to the generators. Now, I'm going to bring another angle that was presented by ESCOM last week. ESCOM is saying this bill might bring uncertainty, especially when it relates to key customers, because the key customers were subsidizing the residential. The money is made from the key customers. And I, you know, for me, this the way it gets a bit difficult. My little understanding that even tax policy in South Africa is meant for cross-subsidization. Now, the poor subsidize the rich. I mean, the rich subsidize, sorry, the other way. The rich subsidize the poor, even tax policies. I believe that's an accepted norm of a progressive nature of our tax policy. You tax the rich more and the poor less. So even in energy, why would that be a problem if we apply the same analogy to energy? Now, the other point that you raised is on offenses, which is a very interesting point. You are saying on Section 88, and I never thought about it, it's only now that I'm really thinking about it. You're saying, I'm trying to summarize, you are raising concerns that this cannot be in law. They are not provided for. This in law, this thing cannot never be regarded a violation or transgression of this provisions of Section 36 and 37 can never be regarded as criminal offenses in law. I think that's the way I understand your submission. And that's a very important point. I've not thought through about it. I've not yet thought through it. Can you elaborate more on it? I think because it's going to be a very interesting point. The last one is just my concern, this one. And I would want you to make a comment on this one, which is Section 30. I think I've missed. Yeah, Section 33.2A. And, 2A, which, let me just read it quickly. It says, if any interest due in respect of any securities remains unpaid for 3 months after demand, therefore, in writing has been lodged with its mother holder, thereof may apply to the High Court, having jurisdiction for the appointment of a receiver of the revenues and assets referred to in subsection 1. B, the court may make such an order and give such direction as in the circumstance it may deem necessary for the raising and payment of the monies due. This is the part I'm concerned about, that Roman figure 2, in particular, order that any prices of electricity supply or to be supplied be increased to meet the deficit. And the exercise of such order does not require the sanction of any authority. You are a lawyer. I would want to have your comments on this issue. Are we not giving the courts the powers to then increase everybody's electricity bill because ISMO has failed to honor its financial obligation? Secondly, we have got a regulatory authority called NERSA, which is given the powers by law to determine electricity prices. Are we not then putting something quite difficult to the court to decide on? Because I believe for any electricity increases, there has to be modeling, public consultation. My concern is, are we not going to later complain that the courts are encroaching into policy-making area? Because determination of a price is a policy matter. That's all I'm going
to say. Okay. Over to you, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir. If I just go back to the first questions of the Honourable Mr. Helen. Sir, I'm the first proponent in terms of the introduction of renewable energy, and it's certainly not an argument against renewable energy. The IRP 210 makes a provision of 5,000 megawatts of coal within the window between now and 2030. The issue really is who builds it and when. The current funding problems which is being experienced by the incumbent utility, it required a $350 billion backstop from the government in order to finance that new build. If it wishes to build more coal-fired power stations, as provided for in the IRP 210, it will need some more backstop from the government. The alternative, of course, is for IPPs to come in. So it's certainly, please don't misunderstand me, it's not an argument against RE. I believe renewable energy is here to stay. It has to become a very significant part of our mix. But the issue I was addressing, first of all, is we have to make up the backlog. And the only primary fuel which offers itself now for that role is coal at the moment, in terms of the baseload power stations. If we substitute that with any imported fuels at the moment, the impact on costs and prices remain uncertain because of the international influences as far as gas is concerned or oil is concerned. So certainly, in the short term, if we need to make up the deficit, according to the IRP 10, there is a provision for 5,000 megawatts of coal within that window, and the issue is who could build it and who could build it rapidly in order to make up the deficit we're now facing. I certainly agree, sir, with your view that once the ISMO is an existent entity, that the planning for future power requirements and the mix of technologies would certainly be a role that the ISMO would assume. Just a quick response to your question on NERSA's consultation paper. NERSA's consultation paper referred to third-party users' charges for third-party users of the grid. So it's envisaged as a wheeling charge, and the wheeling charge is regulated by NERSA. However, wheeling as a procedure in the Primary Act or in the ISMO bill is not addressed. What NERSA has done is just produced a paper that says if a third party connected to the grid, this is how the charges would work. But the Act does not provide the guidance as how one would get access to the grid. So access is an issue for independent power producers. Just very quickly, sir, ladies and gentlemen, if I just make a point. I have been developing a baseload power station for a private client. I'm still busy with it. In terms of power purchase term sheets, we are oversubscribed by more than 120%. If the regulatory environment permitted such a power station to be built with private off-takers, that power would be available by 2014. The first unit would be commissioned by 2014. So This is now not possible if the ERA 2006 second amendment is then passed as the amendment, because it would then require a statutory process in order to receive permission to build those stations. So I think the issue, the point I'm trying to make is that there's economic growth, there's jobs, there's investment, and all the other issues that go with what this bill is about in terms of its independence and allowing IPPs into the market. And certainly not from our side a free-for-all. It has to meet a demand. Thank you, sir.
So if I can then deal with the other issues. Firstly, the ones with which I'm most comfortable, the legal ones, I'll address them first, raised by two honourable members. I think the issue, sir, is that we need to understand that this is an enterprise in which the state is the shareholder, not part of the civil service. And that is, in many senses, some of the clarification Eskom is seeking is justified. It seems as if the drafters, and we have very high levels of skills in statutory drafting, we're very happy to volunteer, for example, suggested amendments, and to work with your experts. But it seems as if whoever the drafters were weren't speaking as a lawyer, given good marching orders. In other words, they didn't really know what it is they meant to be doing here. Are they creating an enterprise in which the rights and obligations will be civil rights and obligations, like any private company, like SA Airways, for example, with a fuel supplier or whatever. So what we're really saying here is there needs to be clarity that this is a state-owned enterprise. In other words, a company in which the government happens to be the shareholder. I mean, that's really the important concept. And the bill is a bit confused about that. Sometimes it looks like it's just part of the civil service, sometimes controlled by the minister, sometimes it's an independent operator, and the word ISMO, independent system operator, what we're saying is it must be independent. We need to get that unambiguously clarified. And that's something which the drafters need to be told to be clear about. It seems as if they didn't really know what they were being asked to do, so that can be clarified. Then also things like offences and the roles of the courts. Yes, the courts should not be involved in determining policy or prices. Excellent point. But on the other hand, adjudication should be by the courts. That's the meaning of the word separation of powers, is that adjudication is done by the judiciary, not the executive. So whatever there is to be adjudicated, settlement of disputes, that can be settled administratively, but the ultimate right of appeal ought to be to the judiciary, and there are all sorts of very, very good reasons for that. Judges and magistrates have tenure, they're truly independent. The way courts are set up physically and legally is to be able to do adjudication. You know, rights of access to information, cross-examining witnesses, pleadings, and so on and so forth, all of which are the checks and balances to ensure that justice is not just done but seen to be done. And an administrative quasi-court is not equipped to perform that function. It just can't do it, and it's administratively it can't. It doesn't have precedent, it doesn't have pleadings, and doesn't have all of the ramifications of a judiciary. So what we're saying is separate the judicial functions out and let them be performed by the judiciary to the extent there's an appeal. In other words, you can have administrative decisions governed by the Act, objective criteria, all of that, but judicial functions need to, as far as possible, be judicial for all sorts of practical reasons. And we're very, very happy to come back to you, sir, with elaboration on that. And if I may say, we do have considerable expertise. We've worked a lot with the State Attorney's Office on many laws and dealing with how to make sure they're constitutional, including the separation of powers, which is, if I may say, one of the issues that's very easy to forget and very much a responsibility of you as legislators to keep that constantly in mind. The executive must execute. It mustn't make laws. It mustn't just be another way of making law. you must be lawmakers. The judiciary must adjudicate, and so on. So if I can, this to us is a very passionate issue, and we, which is a central plank of our constitution, and we need to, this bill doesn't reflect that. That's our concern. And then, sir, that provision you refer to on page 10, I looked at it with some surprise because the way you put it, I thought, surely we never said that, and I realize now the wording is ambiguous. What we're saying is not that what's proposed can't be done. What we're saying is we're agreeing with you and the government and the bill that what we have in the past must not apply in the future. In other words, it's a reference not to what you're doing, but a reference to what you've inherited and what you're changing. In other words, sorry for the ambiguity, but it's actually intended to be an endorsement of this initiative. So, I was startled when you spoke, and when I read it, I can see how it lends itself to that interpretation. So, my apologies, sir. On the question of carbon constraints, as I say, we are not environmental experts. We make it very clear that we aren't, and we don't take positions on environmental issues. But what we're saying here is, and if I can endorse and strengthen what my colleague Temba said, is two issues. One is environmental policy needs to be determined, in a sense, independently of this. Now, let me give you an analogy. In transport, for example, the fuel that airlines must use, the way vehicles have to be structured and so on, these are not transport policy. They're environmental policy. And in, the same here. We need to separate energy policy from environmental policy. And I don't know if this committee considers itself equipped to be determining environmental policy. In other words, you know, we would say stick to what you're good at, which is energy policy, and then whatever the environmental policy is, as Temba says, remember it comes at a very substantial cost, especially in the short term. In other words, if we want enough energy in the short term to grow and to create jobs, the easy way to do that is coal. The difficult way and the slow way to do that is renewables, at least costly cost. So if we want affordable energy quickly, then it does seem as if we need to be very clear about the trade-offs, the costs. And without going into energy policy, we as South Africa, with one of the world's highest rates of unemployment, with basically stagnation of investment because there's not enough energy, need to see this as a crisis needing very short-term manning the pumps. We need to find a quick solution. But on the energy policy, that must be very clear to the government, as with cross-subsidies, that, and let me deal with that in the same context, is so that expecting some consumers to pay for the consumption of others is not the analogy that was raised with tax. If you want subsidies, it should be out of tax. If you charge some consumers, for example, intensive energy users who create jobs and wealth, money to subsidize domestic consumers, then you are not having a fiscal policy. You're now having a policy that is penalizing investment and growth in order to achieve a social objective. The social objective must come out of the housing department or out of the welfare department. It's not your job, with respect, Mr. Chair, in the Energy Committee to formulate social policy, how much some people should subsidize others. This is not the job of energy policy. This is the job of the Treasury and other government departments, the welfare departments. And Eskom raises a good point. It is expected to perform social and welfare functions. It's not equipped to do that. It doesn't have the expertise, doesn't have the people, doesn't have the skill, doesn't have the budgets. And like South African Airways or the railways, they're not expected to perform a welfare function. They operate as an enterprise. And this is what we need in energy policy. Eskom and the ISMA need to be enterprises, and they need to be relieved of welfare policy. They're not capable of formulating. It's not their job. They don't have a department for it, and they can't even come and debate it. They're just performing it without being in any structural or administrative position to do so. So what we calling for is really clarity on the delineations between welfare policy, environmental policy, and energy policy. Energy policy needs a truly independent system operator and grid owner. Energy policy then gets imposed, as it is in transport, on all the players. Uniformly level playing field as energy policy, I mean as environmental policy. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. The point that I was making with regard to carbon emissions, environmental concerns, is pregnant with another thought, and that thought is, though it doesn't belong in this debate in within this committee, is that there are policies that do not relate directly to business, but which impact on businesses very detrimentally, that are enacted in developed countries and that are imposed on developing countries that in turn we have to comply with very serious cost implications. That's what I was talking about. So anyway, then there is another point that the chair alluded to in our submission, and that is the point of the market in electricity increasing efficiencies considerably. The point about this is with any business sector, if it is unbundled, and you have a freer competition amongst as many competitors as possible, making it easy for people to get into business and to compete, the consequence of that competition is that there are going to be greater efficiencies, greater excellence. They're going to, the enterprises will compete on the basis of good value for money for their consumers. It is like, for example, with the electricity energy sector, that would be the case. I just thought I should elaborate on that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Smalley.
Yes, Chair, I will be quick. You know, in some of the reading material, it refers back to that should the IPP fails to supply for whatever reason, Eskom must then supply with that, meaning that they've got to have some sort of reserve margin. Making the playing field equal, should we then in the license agreement or then in the ambits of the Act then request the same, that a IPP have a certain reserve margin in their supply, you know, with the license agreement? Because obviously it is capital that will force Eskom or IPP to have should someone fail, and I'm just trying to see how to deal with that in order to make that feel, if you catch my drift in that.
May I respond to that, sir? So, beg your pardon.
Thank you. I mean, it's becoming quite an interesting discussion, this, but I think these points do need to be teased out. I mean, the point around, you know, that we're not dealing with environmental policy, we're dealing with energy policy. I mean, you're right on that. The point is, though, is that there is an environmental policy, and which informs the kind of energy policy that we then have to formulate. Now, here we go again. And what we have to discuss as the Energy Committee is how best do we draft policy that is going to meet our energy needs, but at the same time take into account government policy that has been stipulated around environmental issues. So, you know, you can't separate these two out. Energy makes up 60% of our emissions in South Africa. This sector plays a huge role. If we're going to be carbon constrained, we have to deal with this reality. So we can't separate these two out. The issue around the 5,000 megawatts of coal that's been put in the IRP, I don't have a problem with that. I personally, given the experience of Medupi, and when you say that coal is the cheapest form, I don't think Medupi is going to come in that cheap. So I think we've got a problem with that. But and I don't have a problem with IPPs building most of the 5,000 megawatts of coal. I think that is the way to go. My problem is, though, is that if we are going to allow wheeling, and you talk about a level playing field, then clearly a company is going to want to buy coal-fired power if you say it's the cheapest. And the issue is then that if you've got these private arrangements where big energy users are just buying coal-fired power from an IPP, then essentially they are getting it at a cheaper price than what the rest of the country is having to buy because we have to blend it with the renewables and all of that. The issue for me then is how do we create a level playing field to avoid this weeding problem whereby only coal-fired power gets used to wheel through the grid, and then we have a problem with our policies around that. That's the conundrum that I'm trying to deal with, so we have to look at that.
Just trying to think to what extent should one allow or constrain that, but I'll allow it. Yeah, as I had said, I have a draft in front of me looking at how we handle the whole reconfiguration of this, not just the law. So we'll keep the records. You don't have to be pressurized to respond to that. And of course, by the way, you're not off the hook. It means when you handle the rest of this project, you definitely have to be part of our deliberations in future. Mm. But it's over to you now. Honourable members, I want us to round up towards the break. Any other inputs, questions and comments? Fine, this is the last round there. Over to you, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir. First question on requirements for IPPs to have in terms of who provides the reserve margin. If we have an ISMO and the ISMO is a truly independent entity, the ISMO then plans its grid, it plans the supply, and that supply has to match the demand. The ISMO also puts out into the market its requirements for reserve margin, and those services are actually provided by whoever, whether it's Eskom or an IPP, and they pay for it. So point I wish to make, I think that's very important, is that IPPs have a financing structure which is very severe. If I do not meet my commercial operation date, the penalties I have are so severe that every due diligence that's ever done on a contractual suite of documents to build an IPP are so severely scrutinized that the lenders are actually quite satisfied when they lend the money that it will happen. This is unfortunately not the case with Eskom. Every delay that has happened to Medupi is a risk that's passed on to the consumer. Eskom does not have a penalty for not coming on stream on a commercial operation date. The consumer has the penalty. So, as far as the IPPs are concerned, its financing structure reduces risk to a considerable extent, and the reliability on that power is actually quite high. So, if there's an IPP program and there is a requirement for reserve margin from the IPPs, that requirement will be specified in any inquiry which goes out from the ISMO, and that service is paid for, and the IPP is happy to provide that service. next question really is around the coal-fired stations, and the Honourable Mr. Kralen, can I separate two issues? I think it would be useful to understand it that way. The one is we have a backlog. We have a backlog of power that is a brake on this economy that I think few people appreciate. We need to get rid of the backlog. When the backlog has been taken care of, whatever amendments to policy comes in as far as who builds coal-fired power stations, who are private off-takers, I think then policy has the luxury of determining that. But I think as long as we have a backlog of power in this country, a decision needs to be made as to who would build it. Would the requirement come from Eskom to build it? And Eskom has severe financial constraints currently. Or would it go to a procurement program in which IPPs would make up the backlog? And I think within that context, that's the best answer I can give. Thank you.
If we're done, let me thank Free Market Foundation, Slow, and the other two gentlemen. And let me take note of the passion with which you... Oh, you still want to say something? Okay, fine.
Very briefly, Chair, thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity and the reception we've had.
And just to close with reminding you that we do regard this perhaps as a more important moment in our history and our country than maybe even you people do, and we encourage you to apply your minds. We do in the Free Market Foundation have an, what we call the Energy Policy Unit, which has considerable expertise, is at your disposal with leading experts, and we have a very sophisticated global network that gives us access to leading experts everywhere, and we have been holding annual energy policy conferences to which some of these experts have been, and they really have provided extraordinary amounts of information. And so literally at a phone call or an email, we could and we are available to assist and advise. Even if it's something quite trivial, any one of you can get hold of us on some issues like energy, which we haven't come here equipped and prepared to address. I mean, the environment, we really are at your disposal. And I think we are not exaggerating to say we do have considerable resources we can put at your disposal, sir. Thank you for your attention.
As I was saying, that one of the passions which you have made this presentation, and obviously, like any other submission that then presentation that has been made, will take note when we go through our deliberations, hopefully as from next week. For now, Yabulela Lali, honorable members, can we take a break?
Not at all, Mr. Lucas. I look guilty.
You look guilty.
You, me, very. I'm fine with you.
Ladies and gentlemen from the Department of Energy, ladies and gentlemen from the Department of Energy, down. I want the department.
Do you happen to answer my parliamentary management group? Do you have a business card?
Oh, yes.
Yes. I'm going to be writing the report and putting it on our website. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Honourable members, I'm sure we have settled now, and I can see Netlec and Company Incorporated is ready. Can we allow them to take us through their presentation, and also if they could also introduce anyone, everyone in their team, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to yourself and to the members. Ladies and gentlemen, we're from NATLAC. My name is Fumza Maweni, and I'm representing the Secretariat. I'm with the contingents of the various constituencies who were part of the deliberations on this bill. And I'll start with my with the Labour on my left to introduce themselves, and we go down the line.
Good morning. My name is Tengo Tengela. I'm representing Labour. In this at NEDEC from COSATU.
Good morning. My name is Sibusiso Mimi. I'm also with the Labour constituency NEDEC. Thanks.
Good morning to the committee. My name is Cynthia Chukura. I'm with the business constituency at NEDEC.
Cynthia who?
Chukura.
Chukura. Oh, yes. Thank you.
Hi, good morning. My name is Farid Adams. I am the government representative at the Trade and Industry Chamber of NEDLAC.
Thank you so much, constituencies. We'll go straight to our presentation. The presentation outline, I'm going to take the committee through the NEDLAC overview of who we are and basically the NEDLAC process in general, and then go straight to a process of engagement on the ISMO bill, which will take into account the first process of engagement and the second process. We'll then go to the highlighted areas of agreement. There are vast areas of agreement, but for the purposes of this presentation, there are those that we felt that should be highlighted. Also, we have in the second round of deliberations, we did have areas of disagreement, which we didn't have in the first round of engagement. NEDLAC and our background, obviously we tend to use the acronym. We are the National Economic and Development Labour Council, and we are the seat of the National Social Dialogue in South Africa. We were set up through the National Economic Development and Labour Council Act 35 of 1994. The council is representative of four constituencies, which is labor, government, community, and business, where the council seeks to reach agreement on policy matters through negotiations and discussions based on particular mandates. The process itself, generally in NEDLAC, is in line with the NEDLAC protocol for tabling and considering issues, where government, labor, business, or community can table and consider policies and legislation in line with our protocol. Once engagement starts on a particular policy, they are given to a particular chamber where the matter resides. When the NEDLAC report is finalized, it then goes to the various structures of NEDLAC, the highest of them all being our Executive Council for ratification. The NEDLAC report is then sent to the relevant minister, relevant authority, and in Parliament. The relevant minister will then table the NEDLAC report in Parliament. Our fourth point, parties are bound not to reopen those areas after the of agreement that were reached in a part of the NEDLAC report. However, parties are allowed, and there is a provision that in those areas of disagreement, they are more than welcome to advocate for their particular stance and views. NEDLAC input on the ISMO bill. The Department of Energy tabled the bill at NEDLAC on the 4th of August 2011. That is the first part of our engagement. the task team was constituted to discuss the matter. And it was discussed at the Trade and Industry Chamber, where three constituencies, business, labor, and government, are represented. The task team met on the 15th of November and the 29th of November 2011 to deliberate on the matter. The task team and the NATLIC report were then signed off by our management committee on the 26th of January this year, a copy of which was sent to the relevant ministers and to this committee. Second part, after negotiations, we were given another opportunity to discuss and deliberate on the amended bill that is before Parliament, that is before this portfolio committee. On the 7th of May, we met and we signed off on the supplementary report, which is Annex B, on the 9th of May. The report also is attached. We go to the areas of agreement. As I've mentioned, there were two processes. There was part one and part two. And the reason we're starting with this, with that particular point, and not maybe starting with definitions, is that when we started the negotiations, there were various concerns that were raised by constituencies in relation to the establishment of ESMA. When we got the opportunity on our second process to deliberate on it, it was quite clear that the needs to the implementation of the provisions in the bill need to be phased out through regulations, and there has to be a phased out approach to the implementation. And that goes in particular to...
Can you get the microphone closer to your mouth?
Okay. And that goes in particular reference to Section 410, Section 41 of the bill, when it talks about, which is in Chapter 7, talks about the transfers. So that was very important for the constituencies, because then it gives a level of comfort that whatever implementation challenges or implementation parameters will be phased out, and due regard will be taken. And one of the other issues that came out quite clearly is that we need to be very careful in terms of those sections when they are being implemented, that the security of supply will not be compromised. The constituencies also, when they were looking at the definitions, it was quite clear that the definitions must be aligned to the Electricity Regulation Act. The constituencies are also calling for the definition of procure and procurer to be reinstated in the amended bill, as there was an agreement that they should have been added as per the initial bill that we deliberated on our first process. And there's also the constituencies are also calling for the definition of a generation licensee to be reinstated as well. Also, business will talk more on this issue, that the issue of willing buyer, willing seller needs to be incorporated. Also calling for the revision of the section that talks to the tip 2 about live darts from the control system to be introduced. And the concern there really is around that particular section of the live data and the fact that there's going to be a particular section that's going to be responsible for that, and the constituencies are not quite sure why they need for that. So the agreement is that the wording in the previous bill suffices. Then we move on to the seamless transition between the status quo and when ESMA comes into effect, so that the security of supply is not disrupted. And as previously mentioned, that goes into particular reference to Section 40 and 41. The second point says the same in terms of, within particular reference to Section 41 too. The constituencies, as I mentioned before, there was concerns about the establishment of ESMA, and they have agreed that before the transfers function to the ESMA, the following two should be done. An assessment of the impact of such transfer is required on the electricity tariff and Eskom's balance sheet and jobs, and also a comprehensive engagement with workers, which Labour will talk more of if should their question arise. Constituencies further agreed to removal of the Section 6, which talks to the establishment of subsidiaries and accountability, because the feeling is that ESMO will have a board that will be responsible for those functions. So So there's really there was a question of why the subsidiaries, and it was agreed that since there really wasn't much of a strong case for the establishment of subsidiaries, that the section can be removed. We also agreed on time frames for the filling of vacancies, which were not incorporated. We also agreed on the appointment of staff and conditions of service, as well as transfers from staff to IDMA, should accord with all applicable labour laws. Implementation of powers of entry inspection should be dealt with by notice in the Gazette, so that it could be clear to those who are going to undertake the function on the parameters. There's a call for the revision of Section 38, which deals with offences and penalties. It wasn't quite clear the penalties and the offences, who they apply to. And in our engagements, it was clarified that they applied not particularly to employees, but to third parties, for instance, the companies. So the constituencies are calling for that section to be clarified. We're calling also for public consultation when developing regulations, because we see that as an important next step after the bill is finalized. Section 40, clause 5, 6, 7, and 9, the constituencies are calling for those sections to be amended, and so that they're not basically in the bill. We call for removal of them because what was clear was that they were an interpretation of the labour laws, and they were very much more stringent than what is captured in the LRA. Then we go to areas of disagreement, which we have two of them, and they go basically to the functions of IDMA, and the constituencies have called for, as far as reasonable possible, to be deleted. Now, government is of the view that it might not be always possible to guarantee the delivery of power in a secure and safe manner because of the other participants in the value chain. The one other area is there was a disagreement in terms of IDMA not paying fees, and business was of the view that if government wants SOEs to function in the same manner or similar to that of the of private sector, then fees must be payable. Labour at this point in this juncture, in this part of the disagreement, it indicated that all of these issues will be dealt away with if IDMA was not established. Labour will talk more of that when the committee wants to find out more about that. Both reports have been circulated to members of the first process and second process, Annexure A and Annexure B. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you and open up the floor for any questions. Thank you.
Annexure A and Annexure B, can you just clarify that?
Annexure A is the initial report on the bill that was tabled by the DOE and was signed off this year on 26th of January. And Annexure B is a supplementary report that is based on the bill that's before Parliament.
Yeah, where is the first one? Because I don't remember having two annexes. Can you before we allow you members, can you just sort out that information supply issue? Please, the secretary will work out very feverishly so that we have access to annexes. One as well, or an extra eight, let me see. Okay. Thank you very much. Have you finished, Sponza, or are they still going to make...
Yes, Chair, I have. I think the constituencies we'll make the input when during the Q&A session.
Question and answer?
Yes.
Okay, sure. Thank you. Honorable members, Honorable Smale, is that all? Okay.
Yes, Jay. It's interesting, when NetLac referred to that it's got a talk to a phased-in approach to minimize the risk of energy supply. It was also one of Eskom's proposals. But I would like to what is NetLac's approach? Where, what time frames? Because Eskom was very vague on actual time frames, and what is NetLac's approach on that? You're very quiet. Everybody, or most of every representative that we have had, spoke about the independence of the grid, and that the independence of the grid should be maintained and should be transferred. But I haven't heard you or NetLac's response on that. What is NetLac's response on the grid? Should it be independent? Where should it lie? Should it also be transferred? Should it remain with Eskom? And then the transfer of assets, maybe a little bit more on that. Thank you.
Just before we go any further, NetLac is made up of four constituencies. The report they present here is a unique situation. They present what has been agreed upon by the four constituencies, and they present what is the disagreement. Now, unless you can answer the questions that are coming, because I don't want to put NetLac under spotlight like it's one of the presenters. The name and character of what you are doing is to present the outcome of your deliberations. Whereas Free Market Foundation, for example, they were just presenting their position, and that's it. We've got to respond to that. But with you, in fact, even the very fact that you get a component that articulates areas of disagreement, you won't find that from Eskom, you won't find that from BUSA, you won't find that from Free Market Foundation, you won't find that from the energy, you know, EUI8, Energy Intensive Utilization Group, you know, all of them, honorable members, they come here as their own. So I just want us to be a little bit circumspect when we ask questions to NetLac, because they are a reflection of areas of disagreement and disagreement. Unless they can comfortably respond to that, because we don't want to put you in a fix, because I sense, as you say, the constituencies cannot reverse what has been agreed upon, but they've got the right to articulate themselves on areas of disagreement. Am I clear that? Okay, fine. That's a process. So I know it's the first time even myself I've done this, you know. So I don't speak with a lot of authority, but I just want us to be a little bit cautious, and we'll learn along the way as the other bills are coming. Because it's not the last time now you'll be, you know, with us. All the bills of the way, you'll come and present the outcome of each and every bill that you've processed. Thank you very much. Honorable Failing.
Thank you, Chair. I do agree with your sentiments, and I know that this is a bit of a difficult submission because you are representing all three constituencies and that you've had extensive discussions. But I think that now that the bill has come to Parliament, it's our job now as legislators to basically put in place the best legislation that we can. And I think what would help from NetLac's point of view as well is to give us some sense of some of the difficult discussions that you might have had, so that we can gain some insight as to whether we should be looking at including certain provisions in this legislation or not. And one of those provisions, two of them, I mean, one of them my colleague has already referred to, this issue of the ownership of the grid and whether, in fact, the ownership should be taken out of Eskom and put into ISMO in its entirety. Because, you know, decisions over expansion of the grid, where it should be expanded to, maintenance of the grid, all of those kinds of issues is something ISMO will have to deal with, and the issue is whether that ownership should then revert to ISMO out of Eskom. And I'd just be interested to hear what the nature of your discussions have been around that. The other issue which has come up time and again as well is the issue over wheeling, which we have already discussed today, What was Medlac's views on wheeling, allowing for IPPs to wheel power through the grid to independent companies? Is that something that you did discuss? And if so, was there major disagreements, or did you feel this is something that should be allowed? I'd just be interested to hear.
Okay. Medlac? Oh, any other hand? For now, okay, not.
Okay, no. I'm going to speak on the areas of disagreement. But I'll speak on the constituency I represent, that is labor. The first area of disagreement with regards to labor is actually the establishment of ISMO, the rationale. To establish ISMO from the start. We oppose to that because of the view that the provision of electricity just from distribution up, I mean, in the value chain of energy must be within the hands of the state. That's our view, and we articulate the position around socially owned the renewable energy sector and all those things, which actually means that that independent power producers, when you refer to them, would exclude a private sector, would be talking about independent power producers in the context of communities, cooperatives. You see, that actually must be able to do that kind of a job. The other area that we have problems with was with regards to a whole range of issues that start from the first one being the question of socio-economic impact, whether the department had done a socio-economic impact study of establishing ISMO that was not tabled to us as a basis of actually engage what would be the impact, what would be the socio-economic impact of establishing ISMO, you see, and so that we could be able as constituencies to arrive at decisions having been informed by a socio-economic impact study. That has not happened. That's one area of disagreement that you said. It's one area that has got to be considered because we want to understand what would be the impact of shifting workers, for example, who from Eskom, for example, to other, what would be the impact in terms of their conditions of employment and all those things. So when you talk about socio-economic impact, it includes some of those things. We are of the view that the department has not done that, and that, for us, is a problem. Initially, from the start, we stated categorically that we opposed to the establishment of ISMO, but based on network protocols, we would raise that kind of difference and begin to engage with other issues. But we're clear that as long as the issues we have raised have not been addressed, we'll remain as Labour opposed to the establishment of ISMO.
Although it's not coming out of this of this report, unless it's in Annexure A.
In Annexure A, when we started with the first process of the negotiations, the issues that Labour has raised now were raised, and the compromise that was reached, as much as Labour is opposed to the establishment of ISMO, was that the two steps that we alluded to, and I just want to find it in our slide, in this slide. The assessment of the impact must be done, and there must be comprehensive engagement with workers. So it's in the first report, it's articulated there, all the various concerns. Also, in terms of the other question, I'm sure businesses would like to come in, and government, the government as well, is that when it comes to the transfer, with the phase-out approach, that an implementation plan should be done by government with consultation with the various stakeholders.
Thank you, Chair. Also appreciation for the fact that you made known to the committee members the NEDLAC protocol and the fact that we don't speak as independents once we are here. We speak only to the issues where there has been disagreement. I want to take a two-phase approach on this. Firstly, try to address the issues that was laid by the committee members and then react to what Labour had said. Although I know this is not an ELAC institution where we oppose some contest or what we're saying. Regarding the issue of a phased approach and time frames, there was some discussion around it, but yes, you're right. We didn't have any definitive answers at NEDLAC around those particular issues. So if you make the allegation that, look here, ESCOM was rather fuzzy about this, most probably the same allegation can make against the NEDLAC constituencies, precisely because we haven't had any definitive answers on what those time frames should be. What we do have an answer to is the fact that there's an agreement that there should be this phased approach. On the independence of the grid, meaning whether it should be staying with ESCOM, whether it should be moved to ISMO, etc., there was a reasonable amount of discussion around that. Because the report does not refer to that area as an area of disagreement, it is actually an area of agreement to say that as we speak, it would remain with ESCOM, but the understanding and the ideal would be that there is a shift. Whether that shift would be to ESMO or some other independent grouping, we're not sure yet, but it is something that we would most probably have to put before cabinet, get cabinet approval before we can have a discussion around that in any case. So that is the idea at the moment. It's going to go to, but in our minds as government, there seems to be a movement towards taking it away from ESCOM so that ESCOM becomes a power producer, full stop. The wheeling issue, independent power producers, and that is the point where Labour came in to make their particular points that had nothing to do with independent power production, I think. But just, Chair, with your permission, I have to respond. You cannot make a claim in front of this committee to say Labour, as an institutional group, is opposed to it. And at the same time, you went through a lengthy, NEDLAC process discussing all the contents of the bill, having areas of agreement on that bill, and then come here and tell the portfolio committee, we are in principle opposed. I think that is disingenuous. And I'm afraid, Chair, that we are doing this in front of this committee. This is something that we have to deal with in NEDLAC itself. But I couldn't let it just slide by.
Let's just stop it there. You've captured it sufficiently. It's a familiar affair.
Okay.
But carry on.
And then the last issue that was raised by the committee members relating to wheeling, our view at this point is that wheeling in its essence is a regulatory issue and not an establishment issue. And ISMO is directly regarded as a bill to establish. Okay. So if it is a regulatory issue, then obviously we will deal with that in the Electricity Regulatory Act, and not in ISMO itself. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Just to complement what was said in the NEDLAC presentation, you will know that BUSA made a submission on paper wherein we dealt primarily with our issues in relation to the impact on the cost of electricity, the efficient transfer of functions from ESCOM, and the alignment with the two new energy amendment acts, the Electricity Regulation Amendment Act and the National Energy Regulator Act Amendment Act. This is just to confirm that the NEDLAC presentation and the NEDLAC process post the bill that is currently before Parliament incorporates all of the concerns that we raised in our submission that was on paper, and hence we're no longer making an oral presentation because what is being presented here incorporates what we had raised in that presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. I saw a hand here. Was there no hand? Honorable Blood.
Chairperson, just a quick one. Around the areas of agreement, the last bullet point, before transfer of the function to ISMO, the following must be undertaken. Was there no understanding within NETLEC that the transfer would be done in terms of Section 197 of the LRA, and therefore, if that would be the case, no jobs will be lost. Was that not an understanding? If I'm seeing you're shaking your head, if that's an understanding, why should we have an assessment of the impact? Because by having that point there, you might be giving an impression that there's and creating some doubt that there's a possibility of retrenchment. But in the mere stipulation of that fact would negate any provision or understanding around the Section 197 of the Labor Relations Act. I have a problem with that point. If that's my understanding, I have a major problem with that point.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I heard that it was like the member who spoke here about exclusion of business or people. Section 13, subsection. I mean, three.
Yeah.
Or is it? It's four. Four. Roman figure six. Any other field of expertise relevant to functions of ISMO, be the need for representation of historically disadvantaged persons, does that not include everybody?
Okay. The first thing I must raise is that we don't want to present our differences from NETLEC about a number of issues. We'll keep it quite professional, and we'll deal with our differences at NETLEC. But to address the 10...
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that.
Okay. To answer the first question, if you read that an assessment of the impact of such transfers is required on the electricity tariff, on balance sheet, and jobs. Initially when we were tabling our position, when the constituencies were tabling their positions, there were preconditions that were laid that, in order, you see, for constituencies to agree on certain things, A, B, and C, and D have to be met, and we still have the view that there are some processes that have not unfolded. For example, around a comprehensive engagement with workers directly from ESCOM that would be affected, that are organized by different unions. That process, we agreed as constituencies that process, there's no real disagreement, but as we formed the view that process has got to unfold, ESCOM engaging, so that as a country that is committed to preserving employment, to preserving, the progressive nature of our labor regime, we don't experience problems that workers would be shifted from their conditions of employment may be downgraded and all those things. So we wanted to be certain about the process. The mandate, constituencies are representing mandates at NETLEC, and that is the mandate that these issues have got to be raised. They are a safety valve for labor for whatever that happens, you see, so that it seems to be taken into consideration. There are issues about the electricity tariffs, if you read there, that also they have got to be addressed. And the socio-economic impact that we're talking about, it's a twofold, but there's another one raised, and this one that has got to do with ISMO, that also has got to do, the socio-economic impact must address issues of what would be the impact of this also in terms of price of electricity and other things, the impact on jobs and other things. We agree about the Labor Relations Act that you've raised. Those things might be covered there, but there are other issues that have got to be considered that have linkages with the whole process. That's why it's there. It's an area of disagreement, so that it has got to be met for it to be, yeah.
Maybe I'm a bit slow, but if you say the issues are there, these things that you are raising, the concerns, I've been trying to catch them quickly in the document that was forwarded to us. And they're definitely not under your disagreement, areas of disagreement. So I would just like to know where have you put them for me to see, because obviously when you look at the bill, or so that we can in context understand what to do and argue certain issues.
Our smaller, if I'm correct, you seem to be referring to an extra A.
Let me be a bit more specific. You refer to pricing that needs to be addressed, for instance. And the only one that I saw with the pricing was maybe 3.7.2.3. Is that the only one that you actually refer to? Is that what I've got to understand with your deliberations now?
I think it goes back to the fact that the NHRA, which is in process one, is not hasn't been circulated, because it is in our first initial report where Labor registered following the concerns regarding electricity prices. So it's unfortunate that NHRA is not circulated, where all those concerns were raised, and the compromise of yes, we need to, as Labor had indicated that it's not like we had to get on with the job, and in order there was an agreement and understanding that those two bullet points right at the end would be done.
From our side, the issue of the subsidiaries. Can you take us through it? Establishment of subsidiaries. That's number one. Number two, 4.43A makes reference to ISMO acting as a buyer of electricity from a generator consistent with the IRP. That's quite interesting to me. Is IRP included there on the basis that it will be a tool that will be constantly reviewed? Now, maybe it's also my understanding of the IRP. My understanding was the IRP is time bound until 2020. What then takes place, or how do we handle that post 2020? Thank you.
Thank you, Chi. Can I just highlight one little process issue so that you can have a sense that the people that represented government
at NEDLAC from the Department of Energy itself is best placed to speak to the subsidiaries as you question. So just for the committee to give them a sense, in the trade and industry chamber at NEDLAC, we have a series of bills, policies, amendment bills, etc., coming from different government departments. But you have one overall convener for government at NEDLAC. Obviously, that individual convener doesn't have the expert knowledge of what happens in DPE, at Treasury, at Energy, etc. And for that reason, you have the experts of the department sitting in the government benches at NEDLAC. So it depends on what bill comes before us at NEDLAC. That would determine which government department players would be there. So obviously, if it is an ESMA bill that has a bearing and a mandate of the Department of Energy, the experts from the Departments of Energy would be sitting in the government seats. And having some of those individuals here, Chair, with your permission, I think they are best placed to give government points of view regarding what the subsidiaries is all about. So with your permission.
Not now. They've taken note of it. They'll have their day or days.
Thank you, Chair. Then I'll just sketch briefly to the committee members why it is difficult for me to actually speak to this particular issue very expertly.
I'm sorry to record that, and the department has taken note of the, both my questions, definitely. I would like us to mix things, because the department will still have its day. Are all questions answered, honorable members? Was it that fast? I'm looking here. Page 12 in this report, 3.6.4, that's section 38, offenses and penalties. My direct reference is to 3.6.4.2, where it said in the report, consequence further agrees that the government will revise this section to reflect the section referred to third parties and not to employees, as there was a need to distinguish between criminality and disciplinary matters. Okay, can you just take us through on that? What triggered that debate? I know it's an agreement, but what triggered the debate?
Thank you, Chair. Originally, there wasn't a clear-cut understanding in terms of the interpretation of this point. So Labour raises the issue to say, does this issue refer to players in the market or to employees of ISMO? And because there wasn't an abundance of clarity on the issue, they then wanted to make the point to say that, look, if there is an offence, and if you refer to the to an offence in the bill, it should particularly relate to players in the market and not necessarily to employees, because there's a difference between an offence in the marketplace and a misdemeanor as an employee. And you shouldn't cross the two. And because there was a feeling when they interpreted these particular clauses that they were not clear, and to ensure that clarity prevails, they wanted to make it a point in the report itself to say that, look here, in particular instances, if there has been a misdemeanor, then it should be dealt with in terms of disciplinary matters and obviously in terms of the Labour Relations Act. And this should be distinguishable easily, so that if there's an offence and there are penalties to be had, it relates to players in the marketplace and not necessarily employees. I hope I made myself clear, Chair.
Thank you. I'm looking at section 79. It's about promulgation of the regulations, but before their promulgation, inviting public comments on such regulations. I'm sure, honorable members, for such a significant piece of legislation, it would be appropriate that we have privy to them, that the department, together with NETLEC, once again, they come and brief us. Because at the end of the day, any act gets appropriately implemented through regulations in order to have a proper understanding. Because in any case, at the end of the day, post promulgation of the act as a whole, together with the regulations, we then have to start engaging in oversight work. And it would be helpful and even, you know, quite beneficial for us when we get into that level of oversight work, would have had a clear understanding of as much as possible. I won't say almost everything, but as much as possible. In part of the size of the deal, this is a very significant law. You know, I trust and hope then, where necessary, we may have to be a little bit meticulous and not go into full detail, but a little bit of details, you know, to enhance our understanding. And of course, as you know, that there's a transitional period, which even right now the players are not in a position to articulate that how much, to what extent, and for how long will ESCOM incubate is more before it stands on its own. So definitely, we have to be creative ourselves as members of parliament or as this committee to ensure that we are spot on and we have our fingers on the pulse as much as possible, monitoring the transitional period and up until the standalone era. That I'm not a right trigger some further.
But I think that's, I mean, just a word of advice. I agree with your input, Chairperson. That a word of advice to the department when dealing with the issues of regulation, just to find a bit of a balance between consideration by Parliament and also speedy implementation of there are some, I think, two pieces of legislation that the department can look at in terms of regulation. I think the Municipal Finance Management Act can give a bit of guidance to that, because Parliament has always been concerned about the issue of regulations. That at times, I mean, the history of it was that at times department would pass regulations according to certain committees that were in conflict with the main legislation and usurping the powers of Parliament. And hence, there was an argument that maybe what you need is to say in the regulation that the department must submit their regulations to Parliament for consideration. If Parliament doesn't come back to the department within 30 days, for consideration within 30 days, the department can go ahead. Doesn't have to wait for Parliament to say, because sometimes Parliament is not sitting. So it means the work of the department will come grind to a halt. So the way it's crafted is for consideration, and if Parliament is not responding, the department moves ahead and implements. Hence, I was talking about the issue.
Oh, thanks very much. But also, as a member of the Joint Rules Committee, I know we're handling this. You know, it's one of the most complex things that we're still dealing with. That the extent to which Parliament gets embroiled on the secondary legislation, that's regulations. But we're making it just specific for the ESMO bill for now. But even for the ERA and ERA amendments, will be quite key. Definitely, sorry to preempt you, but because of their significance, let me highlight that both NETLEC and the department, obviously. But taking on board what, Honorable Mnoto has said, you know, we'll have to meet with speed. But Honorable Mnoto, I'm sure, if maybe any bill and or any regulations coincide with constituency period, we may persuade each other and also persuade the Speaker's office to, you know, to allow us to work within the time constraints, because it can't be from us that simply because we've got to have an exposure to the regulations, that they have to wait until we come there from the constituency period, because that's the only period that would, you know, trigger the delays. But otherwise, being the first time, I must say, in my life, no, my parliament life, to get NetLeg to update us on the deliberations of a piece of legislation. We are humbled and very grateful for that, and I trust you will understand that we will ensure from this side, we will make it a practice, because it helps us at times to have an insight on a couple of other things, notwithstanding that Kosatu to had to compromise, but at least we know where they come from. Or the labor, sorry, the labor, you know, we know where they come from. It's an agreement. It's a family matter. I'm not reopening it. But those are the things that help us to understand. You know, there's nothing amiss not to understand those intricacies. Because at the end of the day, we're not just merely members of parliament. We're public representatives, you know. So that has to be taken on board as well. Let me thank the NetLeg team as a whole for the presentation that they've done, and the committee secretary, one of the members, will do his best to speedily, you know, circulate an extra A. You know, sorry, it was just an oversight, because we want you to be as much armed as is possible. Actually, I've changed my file holder from this one to this one, because everything is getting fatter and fatter, because documents are coming in. And I hope you also have taken note of that some of the presentations are actually an addition to the original submission. Please track that, ne? Please track that, because we may end up missing a couple of things when we're doing deliberations. Tomorrow, M46 at 9 o'clock, we'll be listening to Nomsa in Zimbi, as well as the faith communities on environment, on environmental issues. I hope I'm saying it right, but it's because I know the individual so much, I don't bother about the name, but it's the faith communities. And please go through that, both the presentations, all of the members, because they've got a lot to share with us. I'm sure not much, we can call it a day for now. Thanks very much. Don't forget to go and listen to the president's answering questions. He's in the firing line today. He's in hell. Yeah, we put his mind on the frying pan. Jamela, bye, Danki. Thank you.